Our next case is 824-0376, Provision Media versus Central College et al. We will take a moment while the panel is reconstituted. As I said, our next case is 824-0376, Provision Media versus Century College. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready, you may approach the microphone and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Kevin Sandstrom, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Provision Media, Inc., in this matter. As I start out here this morning, I think the key issue in my mind for this case, of course, is it was a summary judgment determination, and in my view, the district court viewed many facts adverse to my client in that process, despite the fact on summary judgment, all facts are required to be viewed in my client's favor as the non-moving party. I think what's telling is a review of the outline of the factual circumstances and inferences from those circumstances in my appellate brief versus what one might read in the district court's decision and the disparate nature of the findings of the district court. I think the district court made blatant adverse credibility determinations against my client in the course of its decision. Attributed fault to my client, attributed bad conduct to my client, while at the same time really downplaying any bad conduct on the part of Century College's employee in this scenario. And that's a critical mistake in the context of a summary judgment decision. As is laid out, and I know the court's reviewed the briefings, I'm not going to go into grave detail on all the facts in the case because there are a lot of facts at issue. But the key aspects that the district court made its determination on were reasonable reliance or justifiable reliance.
Yes, excuse me, I would ask the marshal to start the clock.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's, I guess, all right.
Maybe I'm getting some extra time because the clock didn't start. If you want to tick the clock down, that's fine.
No, I'll note the time for responding.
Sure. I think the most critical bases on which the district court made its decision were reasonable reliance factor and virtually all of the causes of action that were alleged in the complaint involve an element of reasonable reliance or justifiable reliance. And I think the district court really paints with a fairly broad brush kind of interpreting the reasonable reliance issue as to all those causes of actions and finding as a matter of law that reasonable reliance simply could not have existed in this case, whereas the case law is replete with references to the fact that the element of reasonable reliance is generally a question of fact for the jury. And in fact, I believe the case law from the Supreme Court says that the facts in a case must be absolutely devoid of any evidence of reasonable reliance in order for it to be determined as a matter of law. And there's plenty of instances of evidence of reasonable reliance on the part of my client in relation to the representations that were made that would lead to a factual question for a jury on reasonable reliance. That includes the fact that this was a best value proposition for this proposal, leaving a lot of discretion to the proposers on what sort of equipment that they could propose for the project. And so—
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm just wondering, in your reply brief, you spend some time explaining how the harm, which was the award of the contract to Tierney, is that how you pronounce the other?
Yes, I believe so.
How that seems to relate, or the causation of your client's damages relates to the decision to award Tierney the contract, despite the fact that Tierney filed their bid late and there were some procedural irregularities with their bid. I'm trying to understand how that fits into the four claims in your complaint, which are focused on the alleged misrepresentation. Because supposing that, just for example, that this meeting between Mr. letter and Mr. Rudy, I apologize if I'm pronouncing their names wrong, that it never happened, and your client just decided to, along with best value contracting principles, recommend high-end equipment, Century still decided to award to Tierney. Doesn't the harm and the causation issue there really relate only to the procedural irregularities and not have anything to do with this representation at the very beginning of the process?
Well, I think they are related. They're interrelated issues. And first of all, my client did testify and or place in affidavits the fact that had he not received these misrepresentations from Century College, that he would have submitted a bid more with average or routine equipment, and because that was his normal course of conduct in the process of any government bidding.
I think my question was kind of bad because of my hypothetical, but even under those circumstances, and this might be a question for the jury, but the Century could have still decided to go with Tierney because of other considerations besides cost, like Tierney's apparent experience with Zoom rooms and things like that, right? I mean, it would seem in that situation that the key for causation for your client is the procedural irregularities with Tierney's bid, right? I mean,
right. I think that does go to the causation issue as to damages, that regardless of the misrepresentations and whether or not this was a public bidding process, because there were also piled on top of that improprieties in the submission by Tierney, there is no break in the causation. There is a causal link between my client's claims and their damages, because they really should have been awarded this contract, frankly, regardless of whether the misrepresentation had been made. On the basis that Tierney's bid was untimely and failed to follow the cooperative purchasing venture contract content requirements.
But how does that fit into your claims? Because they're asking us to affirm an alternative ground. And so I'm just wondering, you know, if they could have awarded it to Tierney based on those other considerations and there is no causation that's related to this meeting, then why shouldn't we affirm on the ground that there's no damages relating to the misrepresentation that you've alleged occurred?
Well, and I think that's the exact issue, and I maybe not articulating well enough, and I'll try again here, that is the element of causation in the causes of action, right? That there needs to be a causal link between the bad conduct and the damages. And in this scenario, there's multiple instances of bad conduct on the part of Century College. It's not necessarily just the misrepresentations to my client, but in addition to that, during the course of the discovery process, learning that they had solicited and accepted a late bid from Tierney. And so there is no break in the causation as to my client's damages. There is direct causation because they should not have and could not have awarded to Tierney. Of course,
the allegations of the complaint seem to relate to that part of it. That's the part that I'm struggling with, the late bid and the procedural irregularity with the way that the Tierney bid was accepted. How does the complaint, it would seem like you would almost need a count five that would allege some violation of state law regarding the bidding process. Or can you point to me at something in the complaint that captures that?
I don't have the complaint in front of me. I apologize. I didn't bring a copy of that with me, and so I don't have that to reference.
Or just generally, which of the four theories it would fit under?
Well, I think it fits under that issue of causation and establishing causation, and was, of course, discovered as part of the discovery process and then argued to the district court on summary judgment that these issues did exist and were a contributing factor towards my client's damages. And certainly within the rules of civil procedure, at any point in a case, the pleadings can be amended to conform to legal theories or arguments that are later developed throughout the course of the case. I mean, this complaint was not amended. Could it be amended? Sure. Amendments to pleadings to conform to evidence can even occur during the course of and after trial to make sure that the pleadings match up with what the evidence ultimately shows at trial. And so I don't think that the lack of that particular issue in the complaint is some sort of fatal flaw, because that issue was fleshed out and argued to the district court in the summary judgment process.
You know, hammering on Judge Eade's excellent point, what is the, okay, they accepted their bid late, okay, and it was a lower bid. How is that tied to these representations that were made to your client that, you know, money's no object, you know, you're going to be great? I mean, it seems like there's apples and oranges. So why am I wrong?
Well, I think that it's not apples.
There's no representation that, like, and they were deliberately deceiving you because all along they wanted it to go to Tierney, and that's why they let them bid late, because they, you know, from day one wanted to, you know, get you with all these misrepresentations that your client was going to get the job.
Well, I think
there's no language like that in the complaint, right?
Not in the complaint that I'm aware of. But I guess from my perspective, the issue here is my client was directed that Century wanted the best equipment and then comes to learn only after the fact that that's not true. They get a lower bid from Tierney with lesser equipment, and so there is a false representation to my client at that point. And that's directly caused by the fact that Tierney submitted a lower bid with lesser equipment in it, but that bid was untimely. And so there is that link between submitting a high bid. I mean, let me try to restate it another way. Had my client submitted a typical bid, and in fact he submitted an alternative proposal, I think we call it in our briefing, once he learns that Century has decided it does not want the best equipment or changed its viewpoint on its representations to Mr. Rudy creates an alternative proposal and says, well, had I known or had I not been misled by you and proposed more routine equipment, it would have been a $3.7 million bid. Here's my revised proposal. And so I think that demonstrates that the acceptance of a late bid from Tierney is material to the harm to my client, because had that misrepresentation not been made, then Century wouldn't have decided to alter its viewpoint on what sort of equipment it wanted. It could have picked apples to apples between, and then it wouldn't have needed to consider Tierney's bid and wouldn't have felt so bad about rejecting an untimely bid as it was supposed to do under the law, because Tierney's bid would have been higher than my client's bid anyway. And so, but for the fact that my client was goaded into providing a very extravagant bid, and then at the same time, Century accepts an untimely bid that's much lower from Tierney, Century's trying to get, you know, have its cake and eat it too. It's attempting to get the benefit of a lower bid, even though that lower bid is illegal, and it's done so based upon a misrepresentation to my client.
Your point is that the jury needs to figure out whether or not Century would have rejected the bid had your client not used the premium equipment in order to determine causation. And that's a jury question.
Right, and for sure.
It's inappropriate to assume that, even setting aside everything with the late bid by Tierney, that it was Century's decision was driven solely by the better experience of Tierney with Zoom rooms and its deeper bench, I think was the language used. Is that what your argument is?
That's not my language. I mean, it's language from a letter that Century College sent to my client, but also, of course, pointing out that price was a factor, too, that drove Century's decision to select Tierney's bid. And so had that issue not been there, would the outcome have been the same, or would it have been different? I think that's
it. Did they consider the second bid? Did Century consider the second lower bid and say we're still going with Tierney? Is that what the record shows?
The record shows, from my client's perspective, he engaged in an interview process with Century's bid reviewers in early May of that year. And in that process, that's where he submitted this alternate proposal at a lower price. And they said, ironically, they said, well, that wasn't in your original bid. This is untimely. We're not gonna consider that. Now, there's a disputed, I think a disputed fact about that, because during the course of the discovery process and Mr. Rohleder's deposition, he claims that he did consider my client's lower cost proposal.
Still picked Tierney.
But that's a disputed issue of fact, because my client says expressly in the course of that interview process, he was told by Century, we aren't going to look at your lower priced bid because that was improperly submitted late.
So if they didn't consider the lower priced bid, then your theory of causation can be directly linked to the alleged misrepresentation,
which wouldn't rely on
the late bid by Tierney. It would just rely on the fact that the jury needs to decide whether or not Century truly decided to go with Tierney because of their experience, or whether or not the fact that they never considered your lower bid might have made a difference, and the jury will have to decide that issue. Am I understanding that right?
Yes, and I think that plays into the unfairness of Tierney's bid was late, and yet my client's other proposal was late, and they said, we're not going to consider your late proposal, but we are going to consider Tierney's late proposal. And just as I have a fraction of a minute left here, the other thing that sticks in my craw a lot is this issue of unclean hands or in pari delecto, and that my client's bad conduct somehow precludes them from asserting any sort of claim for relief in this case. And again, that being a factual issue, as we've pointed out, and my client making an effort to purge their any improper involvement in the process when they said to Century, please, just start the process over. I mean, what more could my client do to rectify the situation and then ask Century, you've screwed this whole process up start to finish. Please just start over. You have the right to do that under the law. Just do that. And so my client can't be faulted for any of their conduct in this situation, in my view, because they asked for the perfect relief from Century and Century rejected it. And I see I'm beyond my time. I'll reserve any more comments for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Sandstrom. We'll now hear for counsel for respondents, please. And I would just simply say, if Ms. Hayes wishes to rejoin the marshal, she may do so.
Good morning, Your Honors. Excuse me. My name is Alex Sloan. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondents in this case, Century College, John Rohleder, and Minnesota State. So may it please the court, counsel, I have just a few points that I'd like to make that fall into three buckets. Each of these buckets is an independently sufficient reason why the court can affirm the district court. The first bucket has to do with why the element of reasonable reliance in this case was appropriate for determination as a matter of law. Second bucket has to do with the proper standards for application and review of in pari delicto and unclean hands doctrines. And the third bucket has to do with what most of the discussion so far has been, which is the lack of evidence that PMI suffered an injury here. And based on, I'll stick with the first bucket unless Your Honors want me to go in a different order. So that's the reasonable reliance element. And so the representation has been reasonable reliance is a jury issue unless the record's a blank slate. And that's just not correct under Minnesota law. Respondents cited numerous cases on pages 16 through 18 of the briefing, including Nicolette Restoration, Yavinsky, and Valspar, all of which are published cases, where reasonable reliance was decided as a matter of law, not on a blank slate. And if you look at those cases, there are kind of two circumstances in which that's appropriate. The first is where the statement is contrary to law. And so where, you know, there's a representation that's contradicted by law, reliance on that statement can't possibly be. It's per se unreasonable.
But I think this is going to overarch all of the buckets you're going to talk about, but isn't the broader issue here whether or not the district court viewed the evidence in the light most favorable to PMI? I mean, that's really kind of touches on everything, right?
Let me give an example of the contrary to law bucket. So I think in this case, the district court has to make two factual findings to get to that contrary, the conflict with law between the alleged representation and the law. It has to find that the representation was money is no object. We're not looking to consider cost, and that those are the statements that were relied on. And so all of that is directly from John Rudy's testimony. In fact, if the court were to credit,
I feel like this argument in your brief, it seems almost though you're conflating the idea of the district court looked to the testimony of, you know, one of the, you know, the appellant here, versus construing the record in the light most favorable to the appellant, right? Those are two different things in my mind. You can get testimony from someone, and it's how that testimony is viewed, regardless of whether or not they're a party and they're the non-moving party, right?
Well, I think there are two sources of evidence on this issue. One is John Rudy's testimony, and that is John Rolliter told me money is no issue. He meant it literally, and I relied on that statement. The other source of evidence on that is John Rolliter, which is I didn't make those statements, in which case the case has to be dismissed because we don't have the statements.
But the district court can't rely on the latter, following up on Judge Eads' point on summary judgment.
Not.
I mean, so
of course not.
We have to. He needed to. The district court needed to assume that, you know, those statements were made, and then decide why, even if they were made, they weren't reasonable. The reliance wasn't reasonable as a matter of law. And in looking at the cases, I mean, I'm looking at your cases, you know, Nicollet Restoration, Javinsky, you know, and those seem to turn on, well, you know, the mayor and the state board never would have had, you know, you should have known that they couldn't have made that promises. So how is it that Mr. Sandstrom's client should have known that, you know, whatever, and I've forgotten his name, you know, when he said, money's no object, we just want the best, he should have known, well, you know, in Minnesota, we do lowest responsible bidder, and anybody knows that, and, you know, and therefore you lose. And now, what case says he should have known the bidding process and should have known that whatever that individual said is, you know, you can't, it's not worth anything. You still got to do lowest responsible bidder.
Well, I want to be clear. It's not lowest responsible bidder. This was best value.
I'm sorry, best
value. But Minnesota statutes require even best value to consider price.
And you agree this was a best value bid, right?
Yes.
As written, it was a best value bid.
Yes.
So when the bid says that notwithstanding anything to the RFB says, when notwithstanding anything to the contrary, procurer reserves its right to ... select for order or for negotiation a proposal other than the one with the lowest cost. Tell me why that's inconsistent with Mr. Rolliter saying to Mr. Rudy, money is no object.
Because 16C .02 subdivision 4 expressly states money has to be considered. Money has to be one of there's a list of permissive factors. It's clear that those factors are not exclusive, but the one exception to that is money is always considered. Money
right, so if you view the deposition testimony in the light most favorable to PMI, why is it not reasonable to view money is no object as you don't need to submit the lowest cost bid here? You can submit a bid that uses more expensive equipment than you might normally submit. And we want to do something with this with these COVID relief funds. We have more money than we might usually have. So give us a nice bid. And then the RFB comes out and it says, hey, you can select a proposal other than the one with the lowest cost. That's 100%. In my mind, that seems very consistent with saying money is no object. Why is that wrong?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, again, from the only source of law on this, John Rudy's testimony. I'm sorry, the only source of fact on this, John Rudy's testimony. He took it 100% literally. His first reaction in his testimony was, how can I spend $48 million on AV equipment? He was going beyond putting nice equipment in the bid. He was trying to take advantage of this.
He should have known money is no object really doesn't mean money is no object. It still needs to be best value.
Yes, exactly. It has to be best value. That's the only thing that other than lowest responsible bidder.
But in their reply brief, they point out that maybe you can point to something in the record that rebuts this, but there is no allegation that they inflated or anything in the record that they inflated the labor cost that would go into putting this equipment in, right? So, yes, they selected, consistent with what Road Leader said, the best equipment, but they didn't try to juice the amount that they would make in installing that. So it's not, there's any sort of allegation of fraud in how they put together the bid and overestimating the number of hours necessary to install, right? I mean, what's your response to that?
One thing I would note is per the contract that Provision has with the state, they get a set percentage of markup on the on each piece of equipment. So each extra dollar they spend on AV equipment for the project, they get I think it's 7%, so 7 cents each dollar. So as they're spending an extra $1 million, they're getting an extra, I guess that would be $70,000. So that's where that I think sort of. That's why this was, as he put it, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The high-cost equipment, it's not just, you know, that cost passing through from the vendor to the school. PMI is getting its piece, too.
So what should PMI have done? Would the appropriate thing to do, say, I'm not going to bid in this situation, or to immediately ask a question once the bidding opens up, hey, did everyone else have this meeting with Mr. Road Leader? What's the state's position on that?
My understanding is from the evidence that John Rudy knew this was a meeting that was not happening with the other potential vendors. And so I think at that point he already...
But I think his deposition testimony, he said, to my knowledge, no. So that's a little different than saying I affirmatively know that no other bidder, which was only Tierney in this situation, right? There's four total...
At that point, I don't think the bids hadn't been submitted. So there were four that were considering bidding. Two of them ultimately did bid.
I mean, but you agree there's a distinction between saying, to my knowledge, no, and saying I affirmatively know that no one else had this information.
Fair enough. But he knew that having a one-on-one meeting where you're discussing what's going to be in an upcoming bid is improper. So I think one opportunity would be to... report that, say, at the beginning of the process, before this thing has turned against you, you need to start this over. You need to rebid this. A second would be, as Your Honor just suggested, the question and answer process. If you've gotten some information outside the presence of the other bidders, clear the air. Get it out in front of everybody.
Isn't that error, though, for the district court to find it unconvincing that Mr. Rudy said, I mean, that seems to be a credibility determination, the district court saying, Mr. Rudy says, hey, these are the question and answers for technical questions about the RFB and the project, not for these types of questions about the bidding process itself. And so why was that not an error of law as to the summary judgment standard?
Well, I think you can look at the questions themselves. What questions actually, we have in the record the actual questions and answers, and it's not so limited.
But isn't that a question of fact? I mean, shouldn't a jury decide, look at the questions that were submitted, look at Mr. Rudy's testimony, and make a decision? Was this the appropriate place for him to raise this? Was Reliance reasonable?
I think, in my view, there is a conflict between the law and the literal interpretation of the representation. Money is no object. We're not going to consider price. I would also note that there is in the record, uncontroverted, a statement that I think it was Rudy asks Rolliter, if we bid it this way, will you grant us the contract? And Rolliter says to Rudy, yes. They have an agreement ahead of time, to without having seen any of the bids.
Right, but at the end of that deposition testimony, he also says, can I start contacting people to create the bid now? I mean, it's still, I mean, there's lots of parts about that deposition transcript where there's a question about how long they were talking. Was it an hour? Was it 40 minutes? I mean, it seems to come across pretty clearly if you're construing the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party that Mr. Rudy gave his best recollection of what happened. And I don't understand if there was an agreement that was formed by you will award us this, then why would you still need to submit a bid and go through the bidding process? It wouldn't be a bid. It would be a contract, right?
It would be, but that, this had to get approved by the Board of Trustees. It had to get approved by people other than John Rolliter. So if they're making some underhanded deal, which is the only inference to draw from that testimony, if they're making some sort of a side deal, it's not that Rolliter can say, all right, contract formed. And the Board of Trustees would presumably never approve one that didn't go through the bidding process. I think there needed to be the appearance of the bid on this testimony. I also want to be clear, our position is none of this happened. Not that they didn't meet, but the statements didn't happen. But if we construe this in the light most favorable on what's actually evidence in the record.
There wasn't any corroborating evidence of emails sent out by Rudy before the RFP went out about this to vendors?
He sent an email to a vendor inquiring about equipment, but all that evinces is that he...
Why would he have done that if the conversation never happened?
The conversation did happen, but the statements, in our view, were, we have a project coming up, there's going to be an RFP, it was mostly about a project that was ongoing at that time. So he told him there was an upcoming RFP, and, Rudy...
Is that appropriate, even if that's the limit of it?
I think it's okay. I certainly wouldn't advise a client to do that, but I think it's okay if the only information conveyed is there's a process coming up. We'll be in contact. We'll let you know when it comes out. I think that's still okay. I would advise just no contact, but I don't think it's a violation. I would like to address a few things that were in the previous. One, the alternative proposal, there was some equivalency drawn between the alternative proposal and the allegedly late proposal from Tierney. One, I want to note, Tierney tried to submit before the deadline. I think the email attachment was too large, and so they resubmitted with something taken out. That was all before the bids had been unsealed. The difference with the alternative proposal is that was after PMI knew the price. So they get to see what the competitor is and then say, oh, actually, we changed our mind. Here's the price. I don't think there's a lot of equivalency there. The alternative bid is in the record. It only reduces the price by about $140,000. I'm not sure where they're getting the assertion about it bringing it down by over $1 million, but that's, we have the document in the record. I don't think that's something where, just a piece of testimony undoes that. And then as far as the idea of a count five, there is a provision of that for that in law. Section 471.345, which governs municipal contracting in Minnesota state entities are, through another statute, subject to that. Subdivision 21 provides a cause of action, original jurisdiction in the district court to challenge. If you have these procedural irregularities, go to district court, dispute it. But for obvious reasons, you don't get to wait until the project is completed or well underway to do that. You have to act very quickly to ward off the project, say, whoa, this bidding process was wrong, we need to rebid it, without the public entity going through the expense and then having it get the second guest.
But the problem is the district court's, I'm sorry to...
No, go right ahead, Judge Eade.
The district court's order doesn't touch on any of these issues. And, I mean, this independent ground you're asking us to affirm on, there aren't any factual findings. We'd have to wade into the record and essentially act like the district court in the first instance to decide... And your counterpart has raised some issues of fact and dispute that seem like they would not be appropriate for summary judgment. What's your response to that?
My response is I think there is nothing in the record to contradict John Rolliter's testimony, which is that respondents that Century was dissatisfied with Provision's bid. If you look at the bid reviewer's score sheets, take away the price. On all the other elements, they unanimously rated Tierney's bid.
Well, let me just ask you this. Sorry, this one last question. Do you agree that the alternative bid that PMI submitted, I don't know if I understood this in your previous statement, but do you agree that there is a factual dispute as to whether or not Century considered that alternative lower bid by PMI?
I think there is not a factual dispute other than a conclusory statement that it was a lower bid. It was a higher bid. It was another higher bid.
So are you disputing that Rudy, according to your counterpart, testified during the deposition, during some deposition, that he was told that the alternative bid was never considered?
I believe there is a fact issue about whether it was considered. There is not a fact issue about whether it was lower, I don't think, looking at the record.
Thank you, Mr. Sloan. And I have given you more than an extra minute to make up for Mr. Sandstrom's extra time. Mr. Sandstrom, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to, again, address some of the key points and issues I think that Mr. Sloan raised here. First of all, I'd point out that the disparity between my client's original bid and Tierney's original bid is really only 17%. And to Your Honor's point here that there was no effort on the part of PMI, Provision Media, to inflate a bid using wildly incorrect labor rates or doubling the amount of equipment that was actually necessary. He's provided a competitive bid, so to speak, just using high-quality equipment, which is what Century asked for. He's not trying to defraud Century. He's not trying to create a $48 million bid because $48 million is coming in the door. There's a 17% difference between what Tierney submitted and what my client submitted.
But where's the alternative bid in the record? And do you agree that it was only $100,000 lower than your...
No, and I think, the record on this issue is complex, and I think what we're talking about here is shortly after my client submitted his original bid, there was some minor corrections to that original bid that dropped the price down a little bit. But then once my client hears that Century really doesn't want Cadillac equipment, it wants something more modest or is willing to accept something more modest from Tierney, my client does create a different proposal that is coming in at $3.7 million. And that's in my client's affidavit that was submitted along with, and I was reading in my brief, it's his affidavit and Exhibit 10 attached to his affidavit where that lower priced proposal was put together. And he was quite adamant that his bid would have come in below Tierney's had he made a bid that was more modest. And so there was really kind of two amendments or two differing proposals from my client's original proposal.
And that second proposal was lower than Tierney's bid.
Right. Okay.
And that's Exhibit 10 to Mr. Rudy's affidavit.
I believe so. That's what my brief indicates. I didn't bring his entire affidavit with me with hundreds of exhibits. The other thing I would point out in contravention to what Mr. Sloan testified or argued about was that somehow Century denies that this meeting ever even occurred. That's actually false. Century admits this meeting occurred. And it's in response to my client's bid protest. When he submits the protest, Patrick Opatz from Century College is tasked with investigating the issue. And he submits a letter back to my client in response to the bid protest saying, thank you for your protest. We acknowledge that that meeting occurred and that, they watered, as we lay out in our brief, he waters down what Mr. Rolliter may have said in that meeting. I think Mr. Opatz characterizes it in his letter as, he told you during that meeting that Century wants high-quality equipment. He didn't say the best equipment. He just said high-quality equipment. And so there's an acknowledgement that the meeting happened. There's an acknowledgement by Mr. Opatz that some sort of representation is made about the quality of equipment during the course of that meeting pre-bid. It's just they try to finagle a watering down of it by saying, of course we want quality equipment. We don't. And so there is a disputed issue of fact there. But in fact, this meeting did occur, and I disagree with Mr. Sloan on that issue. And I agree with you, Your Honor, on you know, the, for example, my client's deposition testimony and the fact that he's asked, did other meetings of this nature happen with other bidders? And my client says, to my knowledge, no. He's not saying for certain that he knows that did or didn't happen. And that's exactly the sort of thing that the district court should have made inferences in my client's favor when considering the testimony. What is the inference from that? When he says, to my knowledge, no. Well, he doesn't know one way or the other, really, right? That's the inference that should be taken from that testimony, that the district court utterly fails to do and instead stabs my client with that information and uses it against my client, saying, well, he admitted no other people had this information, so he must have known he was getting an unfair advantage in this situation. And so the district court is taking inferences from his own testimony against him rather than in his favor. And regarding the question and answer process after the fact, as we've pointed out in our reply brief, contrary to what Century argues, there is no duty on my client's part to investigate whether a misrepresentation is true or false. In fact, if the speaker of a misrepresentation seems to be a person who would have knowledge of that issue, you can actually presume it was true. There is no duty to investigate. The case law is clear on that. And so to say that my client, after having a one-hour meeting with Mr. Rowleader, needed to further inquire again on that issue during the Q&A process is simply not supported by the law. I see that's the end of my time. Unless there's any final questions, I will be done.
Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Sandstrom. Thank you, Mr. Sloan. The matter is submitted. We'll be issuing our decision within 90 days.